and yet he was too embarrassed to exert himself to persuade her to emerge. He begged me to stay with him when he talked to her, and if I left him alone with her, he soon ran out. I suppose the difficulty was that they were unable to talk about Ben, and there were so few subjects which did not relate to that gentleman. Also, I had already noted that Titus was inclined to be secretive about what he had been doing since he left home. He had been very unwilling to answer questions which I had put to him on the subject, and this evasiveness cut out another possible topic of conversation. In fact, Hartley did not show any urgent curiosity about his doings. They talked, indeed, almost politely. At least they did on the first day. After that, Titus was increasingly unwilling to see her, and she being more distraught, I was more reluctant to ask him to. I could not get used to hearing him call her Mary. "Mary, why not come out in the sun? It's cold in here."
"No, thank you."
"Are you feeling better?" The convention that she was ill had usefully arrived from somewhere. With an appearance of banal complacency, they discussed the bungalow. But perhaps they scarcely knew what they were saying. "And there's a nice garden?" "We didn't have a proper garden at number 34, did we? More like a yard."
"Yes, more like a yard at number 34.
I always remember the old mangle in the shed there. Remember the old mangle?"
"Yes."
"So now you can grow roses. You always wanted that, didn't you?"
"Yes, lots of roses, all colours."
"And you can see the sea right out of the window, like we used to say would be so nice." I could not make out what this did for Hartley. I realized I had been naive in imagining that mother and son would clasp each other and at once discover a language of love. Well, perhaps this was a language of love. Love was there, I have no doubt. But the two of them remained amazingly awkward and tongue-tied with each other. The dialogue was forced clumsily along mainly by Titus. They soon exhausted the charms of the bungalow, to my relief. Their most successful conversations then consisted of childishly simple reminiscence concerning pointless details of houses and gardens in Titus's childhood. "Remember the hole in the fence I used to look through when we lived at number 67?
"Yes."
"I stood on a box, didn't I?"
"Yes, on a box."
Why could they not talk? Had her sympathy with Titus been really broken in those years, and his with her? A dreadful thought. Later I saw that, of course, it was the whole situation which made them speechless, and it was I who created and maintained that situation. This time of Hartley's incarceration stretches out in my memory as if it contained a whole history of mental drama, vast developments, changes, checks, surprises, progresses, revulsions, crises. In fact, it was a period of only 4 to 5 days. History, drama, change, it did indeed contain. It is odd that after the first day I stopped worrying terribly about Ben. Of course, I did not forget him. Of course, I expected him. I locked the doors carefully at night. It did occur to me that he might try to set fire to the house, and this haunted me a bit. After all, he was a sort of professional fireman. But I ceased being obsessed with him, perhaps because I had by now succeeded in imprisoning myself mentally as well, and the danger of Ben seemed less real. Why did he not move? Was he making an elaborate plan, or did he just prefer to torment himself by waiting, and thus feed his rage? Was it possible that he was afraid of Titus? I soon ceased to wonder. As for Titus and Gilbert, as soon as they could get away from Hartley and me, they behaved as if they were on holiday. Titus did not want to discuss his mother or his father. He had opted out of these problems. He swam every day, always from the little cliff, sometimes twice or three times a day. He covered himself in suntan lotion and lay about naked on the rocks. Any scruples about cadging now seemed to be completely gone. He accepted my hospitality as of right and gave nothing in return, no help, no warmth. Of course this is an unfair judgment. I cannot blame Titus for not wanting to know what was going on upstairs. I think he did not even speculate, and indeed it would have been difficult to do so. Moreover, I gave him very little of my time, and he may have resented this rather crucial neglect. I had decided by now that Titus was a simpler character than I had imagined at first. Or perhaps, faced with horrors, he had chosen simplicity. Gilbert was a good deal more curious and also good-naturedly anxious to help. He even wanted to put flowers in Hartley's room, only I kept him well out of it. It remained essential, of course. He cooked. He shopped while Titus sunbathed, but I did not let him come to the upper landing. A curious feature of the time, and one which can still terribly bring it back to me, was that Gilbert and Titus discovered that they were both singers. Gilbert was quite a good baritone. Titus turned out to be a tolerable tenor, and could also sing falsetto. What was more, they seemed to possess an extremely large common repertoire. Until I ordered them fiercely to go out onto the rocks, they made the house ring with their noise. Of course, they would have liked to have me as an audience to show off to. All singers are vain. And of course they would have liked to sit up half the night, carolling and drinking my wine. They both drank a good deal, and I had to send Gilbert to the Raven Hotel for more. Even from outside and at a distance they were audible, so loud were their voices, and so pleased were they with the mutual exhibition of their talents. Hartley never mentioned the singing. Perhaps she was beyond caring, or perhaps, like her husband, she was a bit deaf. They roared out pieces from operas and musical comedies, madrigals, pop songs, folk songs, rounds, lewd ballads and love ditties in English, French, and Italian. I think they became positively drunk with their music during this time. Perhaps it was a natural reaction to the tension inside the house. I have just said that I now found Titus simpler than I had thought at first. This was so in relation to his mother and to my own problems. Perhaps by simpler I just mean vaguer, less attentive. But it was certainly noteworthy, and Gilbert noticed it too, that Titus was in superficial ways more cultivated than one would expect a boy to be who had left school early to do electricity at a polytechnic. Where had Titus been during the last year or two? This remained mysterious. I remembered the cufflinks and the book of Dante's love poems. My own hypothesis was that he had been living with an older woman. He was just now about the age which I had been when I was kidnapped by Clement. Baby snatching, as everybody called it. Had someone snatched Titus, and then, and lately, discarded him? Gilbert's theory, not surprisingly, was that Titus had been living with a man. Titus himself remained on this subject silent. Perhaps this is the place to say that Perry was, of course, wrong about the nature of my relations with Fritzi Eitel. I have spoken of histories and changes, and indeed, in a way, later on, it seemed to me that what I was doing in those days was reliving the whole history of my love for Hartley, not only the old times, but all the intermediate times as well. Every day, every hour, I remembered more. On about the evening of the second day, Hartley became for a while more talkative, and had the air of having been reflecting, the talk being the fruit of the reflection. This led to a dialogue which had a most distressing conclusion. We were sitting on the floor, she on the mattress, I on the bare boards, with our legs outstretched and facing the long, high-up window which gave onto the drawing-room. The middle room, usually darkish, was now in twilight, though the evening glow communicated a dim, warm illumination. I touched Hartley's hand. I felt, from head to foot, connected with her. "Darling, my silk dressing-gown suits you, but won't you take it off sometimes? I'm cold. Aren't you beginning to feel that you live here? You think the important thing is that I made a mistake in not marrying you?" "There was a mistake. What's more important is to undo it now. You just want someone to remember things with." "That's very unfair, when I want so much to talk of the future. Only you won't. You feel resentment against me because I went away." "So you admit you went away?" "I suppose so. It's so long ago." "You said I'd be unfaithful." "Did I? I can't remember." I'd lived my life on her words, and now she could not even recall them. "I suppose I must have gone away because I can remember feeling guilty."
"Guilty about hurting me?"
"Yes. Really, I did always feel guilty and thought you blamed me. And in a funny way I had to protect myself from you by the idea that you hated me."
"How on earth would that protect you?"
"When I saw you in the village I thought you had seen me, and pretended not to because you hated me."
"But I never hated you, darling.
Never for a second. I had to think so.
But why?
So that I could be sure that you had really gone, that it was really over, to make it sort of dead in my mind.
Oh, Hartley. For me it was never over, never dead in my mind.
So you wanted me? You missed me? You were afraid to think about me? Doesn't that prove that you love me?
I think you did hate me, though. You feel resentment. You mean now?
You're dirty.
It's resentment, really. Otherwise you wouldn't be so unkind.
Hartley, don't torment me. You reason like a mad person.
Or it's curiosity, like a tourist. You're visiting me, visiting my life and feeling superior.
Hartley, stop, will you? Or are you just trying to hurt me? You're the one who's unkind. There is an eternal bond between us. You know there is. It's the clearest thing in the world, clearer than Jesus.
I want you to be my wife at last. I want you to rest in me. I want to look after you forever until I drop dead.
I wish I could drop dead.
Oh, shut up. I wish it could be all over. I have had my life. I wish someone would kill me.
So he has threatened your life?
No, no, it's all in my mind.
You can't go back now. I won't let you, even if you don't want me. It's so simple, only you complicate things so.
You want to make things complicated in your way. You twist and turn. You're like an eel. I remember that about you.
So now I'm an eel. I never twisted and turned where you were concerned. I always wanted you and no one else. I'm the faithful one. I never got married.
Yes, but you lived with women.
You lived with that old actress.
All right, but I couldn't find you. You were the one I wanted.
I tried and tried to find you. I searched and searched, and somehow I never really gave up hope.
And perhaps that's why I found you now.
I've been unjust to Ben.
Oh, God, can we forget Ben?
Ben's over.
He suffered so much about Titus. When Titus disappeared, it was like a penance.
Maybe he did. But he deserved to suffer. He drove Titus away. I expect he was glad, really.
No, no. He wasn't so bad to Titus. Not as much as I said.
He was severe. He was violent. And to you. Don't try to defend him.
Oh, don't let's talk about that bloody man. The protection of children people never came. I said they did, but they didn't.
Oh, damn the protection of children people. What do I care whether they came or not?
But I said they did, and they didn't.
Even if they didn't come, they ought to have come.
But it wasn't true.
Why are you trying to whitewash that vile, cruel man?
Titus hates him.
Isn't that evidence enough?
It is for me. Ben hasn't anyone in the world but me. He hasn't anything in the world.
He'll survive. What about me? Why not be sorry for me for a change? I've waited long enough. There's nothing so derelict as an old actor. What have I got now but my memories? I've stripped myself of all the power and all the glamour. For something. And the something, although I didn't know it, was you. You can't let me down now.
Do you believe in God?
No.
I think I believe in Jesus Christ.
You've got to believe in something and hold on to something.
People would go mad without God, wouldn't they? We used to talk about that, didn't we?
I'm glad you haven't forgotten those talks. You remember when we were confirmed? It meant a lot, didn't it? Come, Holy Ghost, our souls inspire.
I think I believe in the remission of sins.
We all need a spot of that.
Love redeems. That means something, doesn't it?
Well, don't tell me you propose to redeem Ben by love.
I'm getting sick of Ben.
What about redeeming me?
No one else will redeem him.
No one else will love him. Jesus will love him.
No, you see, for Ben, I've got to be Jesus.
This is mad talk, darling.
Really mad.
Just try to think a bit. Doesn't it occur to you that Ben would heave a sigh of relief if you left him?
Damn it, you've left him already. You aren't all that necessary.
He mightn't want to send you off, but he'll be jolly pleased now you've bolted. You want to make him unreal. But he's real.
Real things become unreal when you enter into the truth.
Our love wasn't real. It was childish. It was like a game. We were like brother and sister. We didn't know what love was then.
Hartley, you know that we loved each other.
Yes, but we didn't make love properly. I wish we had.
I thought you didn't want to.
I wanted to, all right.
Oh, Christ.
We were children. You never became part of my real life.
What you call your real life appears to have been hell on earth. Damn it, you said so yourself. A happy woman doesn't talk about death.
I wish I hadn't told you things. I'll regret having told you things. Of course it's a model, but it's my model. It's where I live and what I am. I can't run out of it and leave it behind all jagged and loose like a broken shell.
That's exactly what you can do.
Escape. Run. Leave it all behind. See that the pain can stop. Can it? Can the pain stop?
As she now stared at me, wide-eyed with a sudden pausing puzzlement, I wondered, is she mad? Is her mind totally astray? Is she just a poor wreck? Or has she become some sort of fey spiritual being, refined by suffering? Had that strange wild look of her youthful beauty, which I had loved so and worshipped, been the first prophetic flush of a weird spirituality? There are secret saints with strange destinies. Yet no, she was a wreck, a poor broken twig, her integrity, her last identity destroyed by the cruel force which had made her abandon Titus. But whatever she was, I loved her, and was committed to her, and had always been here and out beyond the stars, those stars behind stars behind stars which I'd seen that night when I lay on the rocks, and the golden sky slowly turned the universe inside out. Yes, my darling, my queen, my angel, it can stop. Oh, if only I could touch and liberate her mind. I wanted to see her hoping, to see some dawn of hope or desire, the desire for cherishing, for a happy life. But she frowned now in her puzzlement and reverted to Ben. I've never been good enough to him.
I'm sure you've been a saint, a long-suffering saint.
No, I've been bad.
Oh, all right, call it bad if you want to. Whatever it is, it's finished. I saw her then as innocent, as men in the past used to see cloistered girls and think, we are beasts, but they are angels, pure, not soiled like us. I saw her as beautifully innocent, simple-minded, silly, understanding nothing, a reproach to me who had lived my life among vain, egoistic men and pert, knowing women. Yet also I saw her guilt as real guilt for real failures. How could it be otherwise? And I remembered Peregrine's words, the partner who feels guilty, however irrationally, becomes the slave of the other, and can take no moral stand. She had taken upon herself, as well as her peccadilloes, his guilt. She felt herself guilty of his sins against her, against Titus. I could see it all. And as she took up the guilt, appropriated it as her own, she revered the guilty one and held him as holy. Oh, if only I could release her from that maiming, crippling guilt, and from that empty reverence. God, she even felt guilty about me, and had to console herself by thinking I hated her. She was spellbound, bound by a self-protective magic which she had developed over the years to defend herself against the horrible pain of having married a foul, insanely jealous, bullying maniac. She had been brainwashed through fear of him, brainwashed by hearing the same things repeated to her again and again and again, that it was her fault, always her fault. No wonder Titus wanted to go and sing on the rocks rather than be reminded of those scenes. She had cried a little. The tears of age are not the tears of youth. Stop crying, Hartley. You look like the pig baby in Alice, like you used to.
I know I'm ugly. Horrible.
Oh, my dear, come out of it.
Come right out of it. Come out of the nightmare. She dabbed her eyes with my handkerchief. Let me hold her hand for a moment. Began again to reflect. But what makes you think my marriage is so unhappy? She was gazing at me now with an almost cunning look, as if she were about to produce a devastating refutation of anything I might say in answer. Hartley, darling, you're in a muddle. You admitted you were unhappy. You spoke just now about the pain of it. Pain is different. In any marriage there is pain. Life is pain. But perhaps for you, it all just passed you by.
Perhaps it did, thank God.
You know, so many nights, quietly at home, I used to think of people in labour camps.
If you had to cheer yourself up by thinking that at least you weren't in a labour camp, you can't have been very happy.
But what makes you think my marriage is so bad? How can you judge? You can't see. You can't understand.
I can judge. I know.
But how can you know? It's just an idea. You don't understand about marriage. You've just lived with women. It's different. You haven't any evidence.
About you and him, I have. Yes.
Evidence? You can't have. You've only just met us. You don't know anyone who knows us. Well, like that. No one knows us. You can't have evidence.
Yes, I have. I've heard you talking to each other, the way you talk to each other. I said this in a final burst of exasperation, and I have to confess, with some desire to hurt. The calm, obstinate persistence, and now that superior, cunning expression was driving me wild.
What do you mean?
I listened. I hid outside the window and listened to you and him talking. I heard his coarse voice, his brutal, bullying manner, the way he shouted at you, the way he made you say over and over again, "I'm sorry, I'm so sorry." I wish I'd broken the window. I wish I'd broken his bloody neck. I'll kill that man. I wish I'd pushed him into the sea.
You listened? You heard? When?
Oh, I can't remember. A week ago, 2 weeks. I'm so upset I've lost all count of time. So you see, you can't pretend any more. You can't whitewash him and tell me you're happily married, because I know the truth.
The truth! Oh, you don't understand. You listened? How long?
Oh, ages. An hour. No, I can't remember. You were shouting at each other. It was perfectly horrible. At least he was shouting and you were whining. It was disgusting.
How can you? You don't know what you've done. How could you push in, spy on us like that? It was nothing to do with you. How could you intrude into secret things which you couldn't possibly understand? It's the wickedest, vilest, most hurtful thing anybody's ever done to me.
Hartley, darling, you know I only did it to help. I mean, because I had to know. I had to be sure, to be certain.
As if you could know anything. Oh, you've hurt me so much. I'll never forgive you. Never. It's like a murder. A killing. You don't understand. Oh, it hurts so much. So much!
Darling, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't imagine. Sitting bolt upright against the wall, she was now crying as I have never seen any woman cry. And I have seen many. Tears seemed to shoot out of her eyes in torrents. Then her wet mouth opened in a sort of strangled shout, an animal cry of tortured pain. Then she gave a low, shuddering wail and fell over sideways, grasping at her neck, pulling at the dressing gown as if she were suffocating. The wail was followed by a shuddering gasp, and in a moment she was in hysterics. I jumped up and watched her, appalled. Well, then I did understand what Titus had said about it. It is frightening, and it is meant to be. I felt that the most violent assault was being made on my spirit, on my sanity. I had witnessed hysterical screaming before, but nothing like this. I knelt again and tried to hold her, to shake her, but she seemed suddenly so strong and I so weak, and also to touch her had become terrible. She was shuddering rigidly with a dreadful, damaging electricity. Her face was red, wild with tears, her mouth dribbling. Her voice, raucous, piercing, shrieked out like a terrified, angry person shrieking an obscenity.
a frenzied panic noise, a prolonged "Ah!" which turned into a sobbing wail of quick "Oh! Oh! Oh!" with a long descending "Ooh!" sound ending almost softly, and then the scream again, this continuing mechanically, automatically, on and on, as if the human creature were possessed by an alien demonic machine. I felt horror, fear, a sort of disgusted shame, shame for myself, shame for her. I did not want Titus and Gilbert to hear this ghastly, rhythmical noise, this attack of aggressive mourning. I hoped they were far away on the rocks, singing their songs. I shouted, "Stop! Stop! Stop!" I felt I should go violently mad if it went on for another minute. I felt I wanted to silence her, even if it meant killing her. I shook her again and yelled at her, ran to the door, ran back again. I shall never forget the awful image of that face, that mask, and the relentless, cruel, rhythmical quality of that sound. It ceased at last, as everything dreadful has to cease, even if it ceases only by death. My presence, my cries, had no effect on her. I doubt if, in a sense, she knew I was there, although also, in a sense, the performance was for me. Its violence directed at me. She became exhausted, stopped suddenly, and fell back as in a faint. I seized her hand. It was cold. I became panic-stricken and would have run out and shouted for a doctor, only I was too frightened to leave her and too exhausted to make any decision. I lay down beside her and embraced her, uttering her name again and again. Her breathing became deep, regular, as if she were sleeping. Then I looked at her and saw her eyes open. She was looking at me again with that strange cunning look, as if now she were actually estimating the effect of her fit. And when, later on, she began to talk again, she sounded quite sane, quite rational, indeed more so than she had been earlier on. "Oh, Charles, darling, I'm so sorry." "I'm sorry. I'm a fool, an insensitive idiot."
"No, no. I'm sorry I got so upset and made such a nasty noise. I suppose I'm in a state of shock."
"I'm very sorry, sweetheart."
"That's all right. Tell me, how long have I been here, in this house?"
2 days.
"Has he been here, my husband, or has he written me a letter?"
This was the first time she had asked this. "He hasn't sent a letter. I would have given it to you. He came on that morning after you arrived."
"What did he say?"
"He wanted you to come home and..."
"And what?"
I was feeling so chastened and confused, I went stupidly on. "He said he'd brought the dog back with him."
"Oh, the dog. The dog. I'd forgotten."
Some more tears welled up and ran over her cheeks, which were so bloated with crying that she was almost unrecognizable, but she controlled herself.
"Oh, dear. Oh, dear. I do wish I'd been there when the dog came."
"Look, Hartley," I said, "you don't seem to be capable of thinking about this business, so let me think for you. We can't go on like this. I'm beginning to feel like a terrorist. You've put me in a position where I have to play the bully, which is the role I detest most of all. All right, I don't know what your marriage was like, and maybe it wasn't all that awful, and he wasn't all that awful, but it obviously wasn't a success. And I don't see why you should put up with a violent and unpleasant man any longer when you don't have to. You can walk out. I dare say you would have walked out before if you had had anywhere to walk to. Now you have. Let's go to London. This situation here is driving me mad. I'm letting it go on because I don't want to force you. I don't want you to say later that you didn't decide for yourself. I don't want to be forced to force you. Have some consideration for me and for Titus. I'm very fond of Titus. I regard him as my son. Yes, I do. And he hates that man, and if you go back to him, you'll never see Titus again. You're not just choosing between me and your ghastly failed marriage. Please forgive my language. There's Titus in the scales as well. Let's go to London, all three of us, and then away somewhere, anywhere. We're a family now. What I've never had since I left my parents' home. Let's go away together, anywhere you like, and chase after some happiness. Wouldn't you like to see Titus happy? He wants to be an actor. I can help him. Don't you want to see him happy?
She listened to me, but towards the end of the speech began shaking her head. She said,
"Please, please don't force me to go anywhere. You'd kill me. I've got to go home. You know I've got to go. And you know I don't want to stay here. There isn't going to be any what you want. It will be like a miracle in my mind."
"Oh, yes, Hartley, my sweetheart. Wait for that miracle. Wait for it. Its name is love."
"No, that is not its name. And it hasn't come, and it won't come. Don't you see you are working to destroy me? Now he will never believe me. Never. And that is your doing, your crime. It's like a murder. Never, never, never."
Soon after this, she said she was very tired and would sleep. And I left her. I awoke suddenly. The moon was shining into my bedroom, where I had omitted to pull down the blind. I could hear the splash of the sea and a very faint rattle of the stones which the waves were gently clawing as they withdrew from the cauldron. It must be low tide. I could hear also, or sense, a vast void, a dome of silence, within which my heart was beating exceedingly fast. I felt suffocated and had to sit up abruptly and gasp for breath. I remembered, as I now did whenever I awoke, with a pang of anguish and love and fear, that Hartley was in the house. At the same time, I felt the most terrible dread, a premonition of some catastrophe, some horror, or indeed the certainty that it had already occurred. I began to get out of bed, trembling violently, and fumbled for my candle. I lit it, and then stood up and listened. The void, dark house was ominously quiet. I very quickly opened my bedroom door and looked down the landing. There seemed to be a dim light coming from the alcove, but perhaps it was a trick of the moon. I listened, and seemed to hear a beating sound, a heavy noise, deep and accelerating, very, very far away. I moved slowly forward, putting each foot down carefully so as not to make the boards creak. I could now see quite clearly Hartley's door and the key in the lock. I wanted to reach it, to put my hand onto the key, but I was afraid to hurry, afraid to enter that terrible room. I got the key into my hand and turned it and stepped in through the doorway, holding my candle. The mattress on the floor, at which I always looked on entering, was empty, the bedclothes disordered. Hartley was gone. I stared about, ready to cry out with panic, fear. And then I saw her. She was standing in the corner. I thought, how odd. I had forgotten how tall she is. Then I thought, she is standing on something. How odd. She must be up on the chair or the table. Then I saw that she was suspended from the lamp bracket. She had hanged herself. I woke up. The lightning flash of thought which showed me the dream showed me at the same moment that it was a dream. I was lying in my bed. I had not been to Hartley's room and found her dead, having hanged herself with one of her stockings from the cast-iron lamp bracket, climbing up onto the table and casting herself off. I felt intense, violent relief. And then the thought, but supposing it is true? Sick and trembling, I got up, lit my candle, and quietly opened my bedroom door. The candlelight illumined the barrier of the bead curtain, but nothing beyond. The curtain was clicking softly, no doubt as a result of the draught from the door. I carefully plucked the bead strings apart and glided on to Hartley's room and turned the key, very quietly. I leaned through the doorway and peered in. There she was, in the light of my candle, lying curled up on the mattress, covered by a blanket, her hand over her face. I watched and heard her steady, quiet breathing. Then I silently withdrew and locked the door again. I went back through the bead curtain, trying not to agitate it too much, and in sheer distraction went into the drawing-room. I had, since Hartley's incarceration, kept out of the drawing-room, out of a sort of sense of propriety, because of the long window which gave on to Hartley's room.
I went in now, vaguely with the idea of making sure there was no one there, and of course there was not. I stood, holding my candle and looking at the long inner window, which was now like a glossy black mirror. And it occurred to me that I was shunning the drawing-room, not out of propriety, but because of the appalling possibility that I might see Hartley actually looking out. And then I suddenly remembered the face which I had seen looking at me through the dark glass, and I thought, that face was too high up. It could not have been the face of someone standing on the floor. It was just at the level at which Hartley's face would have been if she had really hanged herself. Then I thought, my candle is shining into her room, making a faint ghostly light in her room. What dreads and fears did she have, poor captive, if she woke in the night? Did she climb on a chair to peer into the dim, empty, moonlit drawing-room? Did she very quietly try the locked door, hoping and fearing to be able to creep downstairs and run away into the dark night? I hurriedly returned to my bedroom and closed the door. I sat on my bed, shuddering, and looked at my watch. It was 2:30. What was I doing? Or rather, what was happening to me? I held my head in my hands. I was totally vulnerable and helpless. I had lost control of my life and of the lives with which I was meddling. I felt dread and a terrible fatalism and bitter grief, grief such as I had never felt in my life since Hartley had left me so many years ago. I had wakened some sleeping demon, set going some deadly machine. And what would be, would be. The next morning, something did happen, which was that Rosina turned up. I had, after my horrible night interlude, managed to sleep. Perhaps sheer fatalism sent me to sleep. Let Ben come, let him set fire to the house, let him kill me. I deserved to die. I felt a good deal less fatalistic and more anxious when I woke up in the morning. It seemed urgently necessary to make a decision, but there was no material, no data, no evidence on which a decision could be made. I passionately wanted to take Hartley away, to London, to anywhere, or rather I wanted to want it enough to be able to do it now. But against her will, should I? Could I? Could I pull a resisting, screaming woman into Gilbert's car and have her driven off? Could I deceive her into thinking she was going home? Would Gilbert let me? Would Titus let me? If I took her away by force, it might harden her against me, and impede that precious movement of her will for which I was so impatiently waiting. Yet could the situation go on? And if not, what else could possibly come of it? I felt it absolutely unthinkable to let Hartley go back to that man, especially after what she had said yesterday about how he would never, never believe her now. Suppose I let her go back and he killed her. I would have murdered her. Could I imagine myself opening the door and saying, "All right, I give up. You can go home?" No. The only piece of rational discourse which I could hang on to, and it was of great value, was what Hartley had said about the miracle in her mind which had not come about. If she could even utter such words, did not this indicate that her mind was divided, and that she had some grain of hope that was favourable to me, some tiny pure inclination to make herself want what I wanted? But she must want to be free and happy. Everybody did. She must, somewhere in her tormented soul, want me to take her away, out of misery, out of servitude. She must be moved by the idea of Titus, and the redemption of her love for him, a new family, a new world. She had only to open her eyes and stretch out her hand and say yes. There were vast, liberating forces pent up somewhere which were bound to break out. It was just a matter of waiting and keeping her here and letting time enlighten her will. I had given her breakfast and tried to talk to her and to explain what I have just written here, only she kept saying that she wanted to go home. Her ringed eyes and puffy face and the unnerving languor of her bearing made me wonder if she were not really ill and whether I should call a doctor. Then, more exasperated than pitying, I wondered if I could not better serve my cause by being brusque. And I left her rather abruptly, and then was sorry.
I was standing beside the bead curtain and touching it, uncertain what to do next, when I heard a sudden loud outburst of laughter from down below, followed by some part singing with a female voice. I ran down to the kitchen. Rosina was sitting on the table, swinging her legs and being, there is no other word for it, worshipped by Gilbert and Titus. She was wearing a dark grey, very fine check, very smart, lightweight coat and skirt, and a white silk blouse, and very long, wrinkled, white high-heeled boots. Her glossy, glowing dark hair had been cut, or piled by a clever hairdresser, into a rounded, segmented composition which looked both complex and casual. Horace would have liked it. Her intense, animal face was blazing with health and vitality and feral curiosity. She was entirely in control of a situation where the other two, perhaps as a result of prolonged strain, had now broken down into helpless, crazy giggling and fou rire. My appearance provoked another outburst of slightly hysterical laughter, and they all spontaneously broke into song again. They sang in round and showed no sign of stopping. An Italian catch whose words I can remember, since Titus and Gilbert had been singing it obsessively in the preceding days. Titus taught it to Gilbert, and now Rosina had got it too. It went, Ravamo tredici, siamo rimasti dodici, se facevano rima e se facevan pima poma pima poma. God knows what it was supposed to be about. Singing is, of course, a form of aggression. The wet open mouths and glistening teeth of the singers are ardent to devour the victim hearer. Singers crave hearers as animals crave their prey. Intoxicated by their own voices, they now roared it out, round and round, Gilbert's fruity baritone, Titus's pseudo-Neapolitan tenor, and Rosina's strong, rather harsh contralto. I shouted, "Stop! Stop! Stop that bloody row!" But they went on singing at me, their bright eyes, moist with laughter, fixed upon me, waving their arms in time to the tune, until at last they wearied, stopped, and went off into another crazy laughing fit. I sat on a chair and watched them. Coherent at last, Rosina said, wiping her eyes, "Charles, you're so funny. You are an endless source of amusement to your friends. I hear you've got your lady love here, hidden away upstairs. You really are priceless." "Why the hell did you have to tell her?" I said to Gilbert and Titus. Gilbert, attempting unsuccessfully to erase the laughter wrinkles from his face, avoided my look. He started rolling and swinging his eyes. Titus said rather sulkily, "You didn't say not to tell." Then he caught Rosina's eye and beamed. Gilbert had, of course, met Rosina before and knew her slightly. He had hitherto regarded her with a prudish hostility which some male homosexuals instinctively feel towards very feminine, predatory women, whereas with gentle, sweet women such as Lizzie they got on very well. However, he seemed now to have suffered an instant conversion. Titus was simply a boy, absolutely thrilled to see a famous actress in the flesh, and to find that she not only noticed him, but appreciated the charms of his youth. They kept eyeing each other, he shyly, she with bold amusement. Titus's appearance had profited, as Gilbert's had, from sun and sea. His reddish blonde hair had been burnished and enlivened into a halo of fine wire, and his shirt, scarcely buttoned, showed the glowing skin and blazing red curls of his chest. His trousers were rolled up to reveal long, elegant, bronzed legs. He was barefoot. The scarred lip gave a twisted male force to his pretty mouth. Rosina was at her sleekest, delighted and amused by her exercise of power. As she held court, her piercing, cross-eyed glance kept moving encouragingly from one of the bemused, enthralled men and back again. They seemed to be quite dazed by her attractions. It was certainly a change from the increasingly charnel-house atmosphere of Shroffend. "What do you want, Rosina?"
"What do you mean, what do you want? What are we to greet a visitor?"
"What do you want?"
she mimicked me. "What sort of question is that?"
The other two roared with laughter. They seemed to find everything Rosina said vastly clever and funny. "Why are you here?"
"Can't you make an effort to be civil to an old friend?
I'm not in a social mood."
"So I see. Yet you already have two charming guests. In fact, three guests, including Lady Love. All right, I'm not angling for an invitation to stay. I think this is the nastiest, meanest, most unpleasant house I've ever entered."
"It has bad vibes," said Titus.
"You can say that again," said Gilbert.
They were ganging up against me.
But is your funny lady really upstairs? Whatever are you going to do with her? You know, you promised to tell me what was going on in your interesting love life, only of course I ought to know by now that you don't keep promises. Anyway, I decided I'd come and see how you were getting along. I've been working hard, and I thought I needed a holiday. I'm at the Raven Hotel again. I like it there. I like the bay and those extraordinary boulders, and the food is excellent, not your style.
I hope you have a pleasant stay at the Raven Hotel.
The most amazing rumours about you are circulating in London.
I'm sure everyone is fascinated.
Well, they're not, actually. I had to start a few rumours myself to keep your memory a bit greenish. They've forgotten you already. You were pretty old hat when you were still with us. Now you're ancient history. The young people have never heard of you, Charles. You're exploded. You're not even a myth. I can see it now, Charles, dear. You're old. Where's all that charm we used to go on about? It was nothing but power, really. Now you've lost your power, you've lost your charm. No wonder you have to make do with a bearded lady. Just buzz off, Rosina, will you? But what's happening, Charles? I'm mad with curiosity. I gather from these two that she's sort of prisoner here. May I go up and poke her through the bars?
Rosina, please.
But Charles, what are you up to? There's a husband in the case, isn't there, if I remember?
Not that husbands ever worried you much.
But you can't be going to carry her off. You can't want to marry her. Really, you are becoming ridiculous. You were never ridiculous in the old days. You used to have dignity and style.
Titus and Gilbert, less amused, were looking embarrassed, and studying the great slate flagstones of the kitchen floor. I'll see you to the road, Rosina. Is your car out there?
Oh, I don't want to go yet. I want to sing some more. Who's pretty boy? She indicated Titus.
That is my son, Titus. Titus frowned and stroked his scarred lip. Gilbert raised his eyebrows. Rosina changed colour, shot me a quick look of piercing malignancy, then laughed.
Well, well. All right, I'll go. My car's outside. You may escort me to it. Goodbye, you two. I enjoyed the sing-song.
She marched out of the kitchen, swinging her handbag, and I followed. Rosina walked straight out of the front door and across the causeway without looking back. I followed her as far as her horrible red car. There she turned on me, her vixen face pointed with rage.
Is that boy really your son?
Well, no, I've sort of taken him on. I always wanted a son. He's their son. He's the adopted son of Hartley and her husband.
I see. I might have known it was a stupid joke. For one moment I thought perhaps, what are you going to do about that woman? You can't collect a half-crazy female at this stage of her life. You can't keep her like a mad thing on a chain. Or have I got it all wrong?
She's not a prisoner. She loves me. She's just been brainwashed.
Marriage is brainwashing. Not necessarily a bad thing. Your brain could do with a wash. Oh, God, I feel so tired. That bloody long drive.
I think your mind's going. You're getting senile. You're living in a dream world, a rather nasty one.
Shall I tell you something to wake you up?
No, thank you.
You say you always wanted a son. That's just a sentimental lie.
You didn't want trouble. You didn't want to know. You never put yourself in a situation where you could have a real son.
Your sons are fantasies. They're easier to deal with. Do you imagine you could really take on that silly, uneducated adolescent boy in there? He'll vanish out of your life like everything else has done, because you can't grasp the stuff of reality. He'll turn out to be a dream child, too. When you touch him, he'll fade and disappear. You'll see.
All right, you've had your say. Now go.
I haven't started yet. I never told you this at the time. I thought I never would. You made me pregnant. I got rid of the child.
I drew a circle in the dust on the radiator of the car. Why didn't you tell me?
Because you weren't there to tell. You'd gone. Gone off with Lizzie, or whoever was the next dream girl. God, the sickening casual brutality of men. The women who are left behind to make agonizing decisions alone. I made that decision alone. Christ, how I wish I hadn't done it. I was crazy. I did it partly out of hatred of you. Why the hell didn't I keep that child? He'd have been nearly grown up by now.
Rosina,
and I'd have taught him to hate you. That would have been a consolation, too.
I'm sorry.
Oh, you're sorry? and I dare say I wasn't the only one. You broke up my marriage, deliberately, industriously, zealously. You worked at it. Then you walk off and leave me with nothing, with less than nothing, with that horrible crime which I had to commit by myself. I cried for months, for years about that. I've never stopped crying.
Her dark eyes filled with tears for a second, and then she seemed to magic them away. She opened the door of the car.
Oh, Rosina, I hate you. I loathe you. You've been a devil in my mind ever after.
Look, all right, I left you, but you drove me to it. You were responsible, too. Women's lib hasn't stopped women from putting all the blame on us when it suits them. You tell me this terrible story now to...
Oh, shut up! What's the name of that female?
You mean Hartley? Is that her surname? No, her surname is Fitch.
Fitch? Okay.
Mr. Fitch, here I come.
What on earth do you mean?
He lives here, doesn't he? I shall find out where he lives, and I shall go and console him. It'll do him good to meet a real live woman instead of an old ragbag. He's probably forgotten what women are like. I won't hurt him. I'll just cheer him up. I'll do him less harm than you're doing her. I've got to have some amusement on my holiday. I thought of seducing Pretty Boy, but it would be too easy. The father would be a far more interesting project. After all, life is full of surprises. The only thing that's become absolutely dull, dull, dull is you, Charles. Dull! Goodbye! She got into the car and slammed the door. The car shot off like a red rocket in the direction of the village. I stared after her. Soon there was nothing on the road but a cloud of dust, and above it the pale blue sky. For a short while I felt that I should go mad if I reflected too much on what Rosina had told me about what happened in the past. The rest of the day, before something else happened in the evening, passed like a feverish dream. The weather, sensing my mood, infected by it, perhaps, became hotter, but with that sinister, breathless heat that betokens a thunderstorm. The light was darkened, although the sun blazed from a cloudless sky. I felt weak and shivery, as if I were developing the flu. My impression increased that perhaps Hartley was ill. Her eyes glittered, her hands were hot. Her stuffy, smelly room had become that of an invalid. She was rational, not frenzied. She actually argued with me. I begged her to come downstairs, to come outside into the sun and air, but she lay back as if exhausted at the very thought. Even her rationality had something unnerving about it, as if it were the reasoning of a quiet maniac, or an exercise undertaken simply for its own sake. She constantly said she wanted to go home, that there was no alternative, and so on, but she seemed to me to lack the final real will to go. I kept on trying to regard this absence of will as a hopeful factor, but somehow now it was beginning to frighten me. And Ben's silence was getting me down. What did it mean? Had he decided on reflection that he did not want Hartley back? Was he settling down to a happy bachelor life with a dog? Or had he some secret girlfriend to whom, in relief, he had now run away? Was he making complex plans either to rescue her or to take some terrible revenge on me? Had he summoned some roughs, old army friends, perhaps, who would arrive any moment to beat me up? Had he gone to a lawyer? Or was he just playing a subtle game, waiting for my nerve to break, waiting for me to come to him? Or perhaps he, too, had fallen into some kind of entranced, nervous apathy, unsure of what he wanted, unsure of what to do. I myself felt at some moment that to be forced to act, even by the police, would be preferable to this empty, echoing space of attentive possibilities. I was now trying very hard to steel myself to take Hartley to London, to drag her to the car, to delude her by telling her she was going home. I felt the time had come to do this, although I was far from sure that it was the right move. Shrough End might have bad vibes, as Titus put it, but it was my home. I was used to it. And here I could communicate quietly with Hartley. There was a thin, pure stream of communication, especially when we talked about the past. In an odd way, we were at ease together. Surely there must soon be some breakthrough, some dialectical change. What on earth would I do in London with a distraught, weeping Hartley in that awful little flat with the chairs piled on the table and the china not unpacked? To whom could we go in London? I did not want to exhibit Hartley to people who, however helpful, would secretly mock her. The fact was I wanted, perhaps we both wanted, someone to look after us, at least someone to be there as a sort of protection and guarantee of ordinariness. Titus and Gilbert might be of little use, but simply their presence made the situation more bearable. However, since Rosina's visit, Titus and Gilbert had been in a state of subdued revolt. They were mutinous. I think Ben's silence was upsetting them, too, in different ways. They wanted a showdown, a denouement. They wanted an end to the situation which would relieve their minds. Gilbert was simply frightened of Ben, afraid of fights and thuggery. What Titus felt, I was unsure. Sometimes I felt terrified of what Titus might be thinking. Since Hartley's arrival, I had not talked to him properly. I ought to have done. I wanted to do so, but I had not. It was possible that Titus was in an agony of tension and indecision, wanting and yet not wanting to run to his father, to be reconciled, or even to suffer punishment, to escape from his mother, to escape from me. The possibility of anything so awful in the boy's state of mind made me afraid to probe him when I had so much else to envisage and decide. Meanwhile, he had withdrawn, a little sulky, wanting to be wooed. I would woo him, but at present had not the wit or the strength, and I was disappointed in him. I needed his help, his loving support, with Hartley, his ingenuity, his commitment. But he showed plainly that he had, at any rate in this weird context, given up the problem of his mother. He preferred not to reflect upon the obscene embarrassment of her incarceration. He did not want to associate himself with me as a fellow jailer. This was understandable. But he annoyed me by seeming to enjoy himself. He swam, he sang. He sat on the rocks with Gilbert, drinking white wine and blackcurrant juice, their latest drink. He behaved like the scrounger he had so proudly denied himself to be. As Gilbert now declared that he was afraid to go shopping by himself, Titus went with him, and they bought quantities of expensive food and drink with my money. They did not run into Ben. Perhaps Ben had gone away. Where to? Whom to? These mysteries did me no good. One form taken by the mutiny of Gilbert and Titus was that they began to suggest that I should do something about Ben. At least Gilbert made the suggestions, but Titus was certainly associated with them. What I was to do was not so clear, but they wanted an initiative. There was by now a little less singing, a little more sitting in the kitchen and plotting. And even in the midst of my other preoccupations and miseries, I felt jealousy. Stupid, blank jealousy when I saw those two heads together, and they fell nervously silent as I came in. They ran out all the time to look for letters. Gilbert even bought a large square basket which he mounted on stones inside the dog kennel, to be sure that any letters which came would not get wet or blow away. I avoided discussion, since I so much feared to hear Titus announce that he would go over to Niblett's to spy out the land. What if Titus went to Niblett's and did not return? Now, of course, I did not tell the others about Rosina's crazy boast, which I decided on reflection was intended simply to annoy me. Nor had I stopped thinking about what else she had told me, although I was trying hard to dismiss her from my mind. I hoped she had gone back to London. Towards the evening of that day, I got as far as concluding that if Ben made no move, I would do something on the next day, something clarificatory, something decisive, although I could not yet see quite what this liberating move would be. Most probably I would take Hartley and Titus to London. I had waited long enough upon Hartley's will, and I was beginning to believe that she wanted me to force her. When I felt that I was nearly desperate enough to decide, I felt some relief. But the tomorrow upon which I was to make my decision never, in the form in which I had envisaged it, arrived. Towards 6:30 in the evening the thick blue air seemed to be getting darker and more stifling, although the sun was bravely shining and the sky was unflecked. It was as if the sun were shining through a mist, but a mist made out of the dark blue globules of the sky itself. I remember the lurid impression of that evening, the vivid, dark light, the brilliant, vibrating colours of the rocks, of the grass on the other side of the road, of Gilbert's yellow car. There was no breath of wind, not the softest breeze. The sea was menacingly quiet, utterly smooth, glassy, glossy, oily, a uniform azure.